Hello and welcome to Paranormal or What podcast with me, your host, Michaela Ford. Hello, everybody. How are you this week, my paranormal peeps? I'm all right. I've been a bit ill this week and a bit fed up. I think it's the kind of winter blues that I've got at the moment, but it's cheering me up. Seeing you all out there in my mind's eye with your tot of something hot and spicy, getting ready to listen to the podcast. Now, unfortunately, life gets in the way sometimes, and a couple of people who I was supposed to interview over the last week for the podcast have had to postpone for various reasons, all very legitimate. But it has meant that I don't have an interviewee for this week. So I thought what I'd do is I'd do what my podcasting idol does, Derek Hayes from Monsters Among Us podcast. Have you ever listened to that? I literally listen to it every single week. I love it so much. And so what I decided to do, because this is what Derek does and Derek's really good, is I've decided to put on one of my really, really old podcast episodes, one of the very early ones and my absolute favourite one. No disrespect to anyone else, but this is my favourite interview that I've done so far. And it's lovely Cliff Barrackman from the BRFO from Finding Bigfoot on the TV. He was such a lovely man to talk to and really, really interesting. And I defy anybody else to know more about the mythical idea of Bigfoot, which he is absolutely convinced is real. And I'm sure that if I had as much experience of going out to look for the mysterious monster as he has, then I would absolutely believe it too. I do believe it, but without any evidence whatsoever. I just believe it because I've read so much about it. And I just think, yeah, Bigfoot's definitely out there. So why don't you sit down and relax and have a listen to me and Cliff chewing over the Bigfoot cud. See you out the other end. Enjoy.
So we are very lucky today to have a very special guest on the podcast, Cliff Barrackman, Bigfoot researcher, Finding Bigfoot television celebrity, and owner of the North American Bigfoot Center. Welcome, Cliff.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Yes, I'm great, thank you. Great to have you on. And before I start, I have to say, I'm afraid my questions may not go in order. They may be, they're a big stream of consciousness that came out while I was doing lots of research. So I'm sorry if we zip about a bit.
I won't mind a bit because sometimes words come out of my face in an order that I don't intend to either. So we're even on that one.
Good. Right. Well, I'm afraid I have to ask the question, the first one, which is how did you get into Bigfoot in the first place?
Well, I've always been kind of weird, you know, since I was a little boy. But I grew up in the 1970s watching these documentaries we have over here in America. I don't know if they ever made the UK air or not, but like In Search Of and Mysterious Monsters and all these sort of 1970s schlockumentaries, as I call them, kind of hokey stuff. And I loved it at the time. But I, you know, at the time when I was 8 years old or 6 years old or 10 years old, it, you know, Bigfoot, UFOs, crystal skulls, Atlantis, they're all just the same thing to me. Just like intriguing ideas that were fun. And I was a little boy, you know, but I've always kind of kept an interest in weird things. I'm a weird guy. I'm super eccentric to this day. But when I was in college, I kind of turned the page on that one because I had a few hours to kill on the other side of campus from where I was, most of my classes were. So I would go into the library, you know, and take books off of the shelves and subjects that I was interested in, mostly sciences at the time, astronomy and marine biology and whatnot. I basically stumbled into the anthropology section where I found a couple books, two or three books that were compilations of scholarly journal articles written by anthropologists on Sasquatches. I didn't know it at the time, but it was Dr. Krantz and people like that. When I started reading about the evidence for Sasquatches being real animals, It really changed everything for me. I didn't know anybody was doing science on Bigfoot. I thought it was just a thing like Atlantis or something, you know? Yeah. But it turns out, no, people were doing real science on it. And the science that was being done seemed really solid. And I kept asking myself questions. Like, how could it be that literally every Native group in America, in North America, I should say, in North America, has a name for the giant hair-covered man-shaped things that live outside of town in the woods? How could that be? You know, from Florida to British Columbia to Alaska to Maine, it doesn't matter. They have a name for these things and always have. Unless there was some sort of conspiracy, like the indigenous people of North America were anticipating the genocidal wave coming from Europe. How could they possibly have planned ahead? It just didn't make sense. Or when you infer the morphology of the foot structure, the bone structure under the skin based on footprint evidence, how could it be that the hoaxers planned ahead and planted the necessary biomechanical redesigns of the foot necessary to carry a mass of their size? You know, the shortening of the metatarsals and the lengthening of the heel segment of the, these are all necessary biomechanical redesigns of the foot. How could it be? Well, the only real answer to these questions is that these things are real animals. And so around that time, I was already camping and backpacking and such. So I just basically started camping and backpacking where people had seen Sasquatches. And it's kind of snowballed ever since then. And here I am, what, 28 years later or something, literally drowning in the subject. So
so how long do you think it was from that day? Well, I mean, it may be more than one day when you read those books in the library. How long was it until you went out into the woods specifically looking for Sasquatch? Was it days or?
No, months. Yeah, because this is during the school year, of course, you know, so I don't know what month that started. It probably started in like 93, like fall or winter of 93. And that summer in 94, I went to Bluff Creek, where the famous Patterson-Gimlin film was taken, and in this naive attempt to try to find the film site, like there was any chance in hell that I could do that without knowing exactly where it is. But I didn't know, and naivete is kind of a nice thing to have. You know, ignorance is bliss, and I'm the happiest person I know. So I basically got a map of Bluff Creek and was looking at it and wondering where could this possibly be? And there's a tributary to Bluff Creek called Bigfoot Creek, oddly enough. And I said, well, maybe they named it that for a reason, you know? So I went there and thinking, and I found footprints the first time out, and just total beginner's luck. It was years and years and years and years and years and years until I had another Bigfoot thing like that happen to me, but I found footprints first time out. And of course, that's not where the PG site was. I later found it in 97 or 98. I actually stumbled onto it and I figured out where it was. But in 94, I went to Bigfoot Creek, and it turns out that the local indigenous tribe there, the Yuroks in this case, told me that, or a couple members of the tribe told me that Bigfoot Creek is where the Sasquatches go to fish for steelhead at certain times of year. And that's why they named it that. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I was told. But anyway, that's how long it took. So it was just the following summer, because I would always try to go camping and stuff during the summer.
Yeah, I suppose if you were the sort of person who believed in fate, I don't know if you are, you could say it's almost like the world was giving you a message. Don't give up on this. I'm going to give you something now, and then it's going to lead you off on this path.
Looking back on my life, there is some sort of tidal surge of divine accidents at work. It seems like there are synchronicities and weirdness and coincidences. It seems that those pop up enough. So whether that's fate or not, I don't know. I think it's just a matter of putting a word on something, but there's something weird going on.
Yeah. Wow. I'm so jealous, by the way, living in the UK. All I want to do is get on an aeroplane and come and search through your forests. Because we have sort of tales of wild men in the UK, but nothing like you've got there. And I don't think that the UK could probably sustain anything like Bigfoot anyway. It's too small.
I have my doubts, although there are advocates of that point of view over there, of course. But I've gone Bigfooting in the UK for one of our episodes one time, and I figured, you're going to send me to the UK to look for Sasquatch. All right, it's on your dime, you know, I'll go. But there, And from what I understand, you know, all the hairy man carvings and art and whatever else in the UK, they came over with the Norman invasion and with like 1100. I'm not up on my, you know, my European history, but the Norman invasion brought this idea of the hairy man, the Wudwosa, and over from mainland Europe. And I think that there probably were remnant populations of relic hominoids of some sort in Europe until very recently, or even to the present day in Eastern Europe. So,
yeah. Now, so you started, I mean, this is everyone's dream, really, to be able to do the thing that they absolutely love doing and then create a building as an ode to that that love. And you've created the North American Bigfoot Center. Would you like to tell us something about that and how that came about?
Well, yeah. The TV show Finding Bigfoot went off the air and a number of years. We've done another 2-hour special since then. But, you know, we didn't know we were doing that. And there are no plans on coming back at this point. So we went off the air and I figured, okay, well, now what? You know, that was my living, you know, that was my job. It's not just something I enjoy doing, it's my job. So now what am I gonna do? I could always go back to teaching school. That's what I was. I was an elementary school teacher. I taught 10-year-olds before the TV show scooped me up. I could always go back to do that, but then I'd have to go back to school and take more master's units and renew my credential and all that sort of stuff. And I figured, well, I already have a following, you know, basically a worldwide following to some level about this passion of mine, this Bigfoot research thing. And a friend of mine named Dave Becerra, he says, Cliff, you know, I have a Bigfoot museum. He has a great Bigfoot museum out in Georgia. It's called Expedition Bigfoot. And he you know, pays his bills. He does well. He gets a lot of reports. He has a lot of fun with it. So he said, you know, you already have a lot of stuff. Why don't you make one of these? And I kind of looked around and another good friend of mine, Lauren Coleman, he has the International Cryptozoology Museum up in Maine. And I say, and like Lauren was, you know, making it happen. And Dave Becerra was making it happen. I'm thinking, well, I mean, yeah, why don't I try this? You know, so I took whatever money I had squirreled away while I was on TV. You know, TV doesn't make you a lot of money, but I also never changed my lifestyle from being a teacher. So I was living, you know, in a poverty level existence and making, towards the end of the show, at least, I was making good money. At least as far as I'm concerned, I was making good money. Other executives would laugh at me, but I mean, for a teacher, I was making good money, I thought. So I just saved all that money and I just built this NABC thing here, figuring that this is essentially, this is me continuing my educational career, but now the subject is Bigfoot, because Bigfoots get a bad rap. You look at the movies that are made about them, and these are monstrous killers. You know, they'll come in and wipe out an entire, you know, camping party or something like that. And I've always kind of thought that, you know, like when I was growing up, oh, let me back up a little bit. My mother was born in like 1940 and she loved the Universal horror movies, Wolfman and Frankenstein and all Dracula and all that stuff. But one of the other monsters when she was growing up and when she watched movies was the gorilla. And my mom scared the hell out of me. And when I was a little boy, she'd say, don't let the gorilla under your bed get you. And I went, holy crap, there's a gorilla. Oh my God. You know, parents don't understand the damage psychologically they do to their children. Right. But I saw that gorillas were treated as monsters when my mom was a little girl. And I see Sasquatches being treated as monsters now. So the only way through that is by education, you know, educating the public on what these things actually are. So that's what I'm trying to do. It's kind of an educational facility. I present the evidence as it is, let people take their own conclusions from it. Because a lot of people, I get a lot of comments from people who kind of say, oh, I saw the sign on the side of the road, so I came in. And they expected it to be some sort of like roadside attraction, mom and pop shop with, you know, mermaids and jackalopes and things like that. They come in, they go, wow, I didn't think it was going to be like this. I didn't think you were going to talk about the biomechanics of the foot. I didn't think there was going to be a bunch of like evidence on the wall. I had no idea there was so much evidence. I had no idea there were so many photographs or films and so it's really an educational facility more than anything else. Just showing the public that these things are actually there. And skepticism, you should be skeptical. Most stuff on TV or the internet are just lies, frankly, you know, just overblown nonsense. But when you come here to the NABC, the North American Bigfoot Center, you like a pretty level-headed presentation of the evidence, or at least why I think they're real animals. And people walk away with knowing a little bit more about them than they did coming in the door. even diehard Bigfoot weirdo fanatics like myself. I try to cater to everyone. Because remember, I taught 10-year-olds for a living. So I kind of put it out there at that level so everybody can grasp it. But there's something here, even for the diehard Bigfoot weirdo fanatic like myself. Yeah. And I think that's an accomplishment. So
it is. It really is. I have to say, I hold my hand up. I'm a primary school teacher and I teach year five, which is equivalent to fifth grade.
That's mostly what I did as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing, in fact, I've got a little, I was going to say it later, but one thing that really tickled me when I was doing my research, I was listening to quite a few of the podcasts that you've been on. And there's one way you were saying that, like you said, you treat everybody as a 10-year-old child. I think that was really good because I think I agree with you. I don't think people really necessarily get beyond that in their life.
No, because at the end of the day, like I'm 51 years old, but I played a video game last night before I went to bed, you know, like I'm still 10. And you know, I'm a functioning adult, et cetera, you know, but at the same time, we're all kind of just 10 years old at this end of the day. We're all stoked to get a popsicle, you know, it's just the way it is. And we never outgrow that stuff.
Definitely. I just really liked that. You have said in the past that your goal is to have the biggest amount of evidence at your museum in the whole of North America. How are you getting
I don't know if I've ever said that. I don't know if I've ever said that. But if that ends up happening, I'd be thrilled because I'm not really goal-driven, oddly enough. It's not really the American way, I know. And I don't fit the bill, you know, for an American because we're all ambitious and goal-driven and whatever. Not me. I don't surf, but I like the metaphor of surfing. You know, you take the energy that's behind you and you use it to your to the best of your ability. I'm trying to make this place the best it can be. I'm not trying to be the best or the most or anything out of everybody else because nobody else is on my radar. And I don't mean that like there's no competition for me because I'm Mr. Pigeon. That's not what I mean. I mean that everybody should do the best they have with what they have. And that's all I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be the best I can be. I'm not trying to be better than anybody else or have more than anybody else or do or anything like that. I'm trying to make the facility that I would want to visit. And I'm trying to get as much stuff out there as possible. But it's not about having the most. It's about being the best that I can be, not compared to anybody else, just my own standards. That's all.
Well, that's fair enough, I think. One of the questions that keeps coming up all the time when I've talked to people about Bigfoot, and I have to say, I've probably been an interested amateur for about 2 years now. Finding Bigfoot was actually my way into it because
we're kind of a gateway drug, honestly.
but before that, I just presumed, like every other ignoramus in the world, that that it was a made-up monster. And it wasn't until I started watching your program and I thought, oh gosh, hang on a minute. Gosh, maybe this could be real. This is fascinating. And from there, I've bought books and read things and, you know, only a tiny drop in the ocean, really. But one thing that I have been quite annoyed by, and I just wondered what you thought about it, is how much of a negative influence do you think people who make fake videos and photos are on the research?
Well, yeah, they've done a lot of damage over the years, and it's ridiculous to me that, and I don't know what's behind all this. I mean, for some people it's money, for some people it's attention, and I kind of think that a lot of it's mental illness, frankly. And I would say money and attention falls under that category as well, falls under that umbrella. And broadly speaking, it's some sort of mental illness about trying to lie to other people for fun, you know, or lie to other people for profit. That's not what normal people do. And in my opinion, I'm no psychologist, you know? But that seems weird to me. They certainly do damage. And the reason is because those are the ones that, because they're trying to get attention, right? If that's their goal, they're trying to get attention. If they're trying to get money, they need attention to do it. So they tend to get the attention of a lot of people and they tend to get the attention of the media. And the media loves a Bigfoot hoax. They will take it and parade it around and show all this. And that gives the perception to the general public that every Bigfoot thing is a hoax because when most of the things they hear about, the general public, the people who are uninitiated into the Bigfoot thing, when most of the things they hear about are either hoaxes or rumored to be hoaxes, they assume everything's a hoax, you know? So, and that's the damage that it does. You know, if it was the same thing with bears, it would do the same damage. If people were dressing up as bears and running across the road in front of cars, and that happened a lot, then the media would probably take hold of that as well. And then the bear researchers would probably be all bent out of shape about it. Right. So the hoaxes do damage to the subject, because it's not respectful to the researchers who pour their time and money into this. It's not respectful to the academics. It belittles their efforts and makes them look like clowns in a lot of ways. So yeah, hoaxes and liars of the subject in the subject do damage. And whether that's on, you know, the local media or the internet or, you know, television or radio or any media at all, when somebody is not telling the truth about Bigfoot, it's damaging to the subject. And it's crazy too, because Sasquatches are actually real animals. They're really there. You don't have to lie about them, but people do.
I guess people are just very impatient as well. They can't bother to hang around and do the research.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. People are, persistence is the most important trait of a Bigfooter, you know.
Yeah, and I do wonder whether some people are just obviously really lazy. They prefer to sit in their armchairs and pontificate about it rather than actually get out there and try and find the evidence.
Isn't that what Facebook is for? I mean, Facebook is about making yourself look good, you know, essentially. You put out the image you want to look like. You look at how social I am. Look at me going out to eat. Look at this. Look how skeptical I am of all the Bigfoot evidence and all that sort of stuff. It's showing off, basically, is all social media is for. And also, apparently, unbeknownst to the people who post weird, rude things, apparently they show off what kind of mental illness they have as well, because there's crazy people out there, man, and really dark, hateful, angry folks that as long as they don't see it face to face, they're happy to talk crap right at you on the internet. Now, like, for example, I get a surprising amount of hate mail, you know, and I'm a generally kind of likable guy. You know, I'm honest. I do my best. I'm wrong sometimes. And I always admit it. But I have people sometimes a little less nowadays, because I'm less in the limelight, I guess. But like if I saw like a political commentator on television that I disagree with, which happens most times I watch TV, it turns out, I don't actually, like, I might disagree with them, but I'm not going to put a lot of effort into scolding him. But yet, for some reason, people see me on television and they go, who's that guy? I don't like what he said. I'm going to do an internet search, find a way to contact him, and then pen a 12-paragraph letter in all capital letters with very little punctuation to tell him about this. That seems like a kind of a lot of effort for something that could just, you could just turn the channel, you know, you could turn the, do, and that's, or here, remote control. I'm out of your life forever. But these people, a surprising number of them over the years, have put a tremendous amount of effort in to write very poorly written and poorly punctuated long rants at me to tell me their distaste of me. But you know what I do? I push a button and they go away. The same thing they could do to me.
Exactly. Why would you bother? It's just
mental illness.
Yeah, it must be. It must be.
Yeah, mental illness, I think, is a lot of it. So there's a lot of mental illness in society today with like a crucible of pressure and weirdness and you know, it's crazy. This is a crazy world. This world makes me very thankful that I am not immortal.
Yes, I know. I think the more I learn about people, the less I like them, I have to say. This is not children. Children are great. They're just really fun.
Oh, they're great. You know? They're unpolluted.
Yeah. But people generally just make me cross.
Which is a great thing about Bigfooting. I go out to the woods and I'm either alone or just with my wife or something. And it's like, it's great. It's great. Trees don't yell at me in all capital letters.
Although there are some people who would say they do.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
So I'm going to ask what will seem to you like a really obvious question now, but bear in mind that I am all the way over here in Britain. So I would presume that the reason you opened your center in Oregon is because you believe that Oregon is the best place to find Bigfoot or Sasquatch?
Indirectly. I opened it here because I live here. Oh. But I live here because Pacific Northwest is a great place to look for Sasquatches, and I want to be part of the action. Yeah. I grew up in Southern California, outside of Los Angeles, in a place called Long Beach, California. And that is a long drive for Bigfoot. So I eventually decided to live where I vacation, which is what I recommend everybody does, because you can stay home, right? Live where you vacation. It makes sense to me. And so I moved up here. And I live in a little town called Sandy, Oregon. About 10,000 people live there. It's on the slopes of Mount Hood, right on the edge of the forest. And the museum's about 15 or 20 minutes away from my home. So it's a perfect location for it.
Ah, I did wonder, actually. I had visions of you kind of living in the eaves of the museum and having an apartment there. When I was teaching very little children, they used to actually say to me, do you live upstairs, miss?
Yeah.
Because they actually thought I lived upstairs in the school. I guess my 10-year-old naivety thought that you might live at the museum.
Well, people are very surprised to see me here. They may know I own the museum, but they're very surprised to see me here. And so I didn't know you were going to be here. So, well, yeah, this is where I work. I've got a job. This is what I do, you know? And I said, yeah, but I didn't think you actually came. Well, you know, my employees let me out of my cubicle in the back and feed me and water me every morning. Yeah, I'm actually living in the displays in the back. So, yeah.
And then you get locked up every evening.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. You can't have me running around loose.
Now, I am going to. So I'm obviously doing this interview for Paranormality magazine. And the guys at Paranormality magazine are fabulous. Hello, guys. And we've got a little Instagram group where we all chat and say, you know, who are you going to be interviewing? What's your next article going to be? And I said, oh, I'm going to be interviewing Cliff. What is there anything you'd like me to ask him? And so I have got one question, but I'm slightly nervous to ask you because I'm afraid that you might baffle me with science. So if I'm just smiling and looking like I understand and nodding, then forgive me.
So, I taught 10-year-olds. I can make it accessible to everybody. It's all right. It's all right.
One of the ones was, do you believe that Bigfoot or Sasquatch are arboreal, that for the listeners, that they live in trees?
A little. I mean, no, I don't think they live in trees, but I think that the trees are accessible to them in the same way that trees are accessible to us. We don't generally go up in there, but we can. We definitely can. And Sasquatches would be even more more like anatomically appropriate for trees because the flexibility in their feet would help them with the climbing thing. They've got longer arms in proportion to their legs and humans do. That's another adaptation that'd be helpful to them. But they're I don't think they're habitually arboreal. I could be very wrong. Maybe that's where they, you know, where some of them at least nest overnight. And that's why they're harder to, you know, locate. But I do have some reports of them up in trees or jumping down from trees when people get too close. There are some reports, but they seem to be not so much outliers because you throw away outliers statistically. But there are some reports that indicate that they are at least somewhat adept at climbing trees pretty well. I think the smaller ones tend to be up there a little bit more, just like with grizzly bears, for example. The big grizzly bears don't tend to go up in trees because they're so heavy and whatever else, but the smaller ones tend to do so much more often. That's probably, I don't know, but probably the case with Sasquatches as well. I have had a couple reports of like 7-footers or so up in trees and jumping down. But you know, I don't think it's a habitual behavior. I think it's something that they do sometimes. Just like I can climb a tree, not well, but you've seen it on the TV show. I can get up in trees sometimes. I think they're much better at it than I am, but it's not something that they do daily, perhaps.
Okay. And do you think that I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that the midfoot flexibility, the mid-tarsal, is for climbing trees? Or do you think that that is just, you know, they've just adapted to their sort of surroundings and that it helps them to climb and things?
Well, yeah, it absolutely is for climbing trees. That's how the trait developed. You see, the thing is, they did, but take my words with a grain of salt here, but they didn't evolve that. Humans evolved an arch. We came from that. We came from a flexibly footed animal. Yeah, but basically, picture this, right? Picture a small ape or something like that, holding onto a tree like a pole. You know what I mean? And yeah. if the arms are extended, and then it would make like a triangle with like the arms going out to the shoulders, and then the shoulders going down to the foot, and then the tree would be the third the side of the triangle, right? Picture.
Yeah.
Doesn't always happen like that, but we're talking simplicity here, right? So the hand would connect to the tree, and then the shoulder, and then it go down to the foot, right? So if your foot could flex in the middle, like an ape's can or a monkey's can, could you see how from the mid part of the foot to the toes could push directly against the tree, yeah. And yet the ankle would come out at such an angle that the leg could come up to the shoulder and make that other side of the triangle, right?
Yeah.
So what that does, it increases the amount of surface area on the foot to push against the tree and friction, and that's how you climb. So the midfoot flexibility is actually an adaptation for being in trees. Now in Sasquatches, they certainly use that for trees, but they would also use it for the uneven mountainous terrain in which they live, either moving up or down hills. If you had a flexible midfoot, that would increase the amount of surface area that would be in contact with the ground, moving upwards or downwards. Going downwards, you'd probably be a lot of sliding. But if the front part of the foot could be, say, horizontal while the heel comes up behind, well, that horizontal section would act as a brake as you go downhill, right? So it's, again, yeah. Larger surface area in contact with the substrate, whether it's dirt or the tree or whatever it is. That's why all the other ape species have this midfoot flexibility. Humans are the weird apes. We're the weird apes here. We're the ones that evolved away from that because our behaviors tended towards, there's a strategy called persistence hunting. And it's basically, and it's nothing, it's not rocket science. Cheetahs do the same thing. Like that goat looks delicious. I'm going to chase the goat for a while. When I get tired, you're going to chase the goat while I rest. And then when you get tired, then I'm going to pick up again because I've been resting. And then we just take turns going back and forth, but that poor goat never gets a rest. And we chase this goat for 4 to 6 hours until it collapses from exhaustion. We jump on it and have goat tacos. You know, we jump on it and have goat for dinner, basically. And that's persistence hunting. Cheetahs do the same thing. Other animals do this. And that is where our arch developed from, because our arch acts as a little extra spring from our long distance running habits. And it also acts as a shock absorber as we pound our feet across the savannah. That's also why we lost our hair covering. We have the same number of hair follicles as all the other ape species approximately. Just so we don't have hair coming at them anymore. When you get cold, you know, you get out of the shower and you get cold. Yeah. Every one of those goosebumps on you is a hair follicle. Whether it has a hair coming out of it or not, it doesn't matter. Every one of those is a hair follicle. So we have the same number of follicles as pretty much all the other apes do, but we don't have hair coming out of it anymore because remember, we're running across the savannah for 4 to 6 hours at a time chasing dinner. We lost our hair to radiate our heat out to the environment so we don't overheat and die.
Wow, that's fascinating. Now, I've been rather put off by my Zoom account telling me he's going to throw me out in 10 minutes, which is really annoying because I thought that I had as long as I wanted. So if I disappear, is it OK just to click back on the link again and come back in?
Yeah, sure. If it lets me.
I'll go and shout at somebody about it afterwards. so my next one is one of the guys wanted to know, why do you think Bigfoot photos are always blurry?
A couple of reasons, actually. Sasquatches tend to be around in low light conditions, like the nighttime ones, for example. And that, of course, makes the shutter stay open longer. And if the animal is moving at all, then that's the way it is. But as far as like them all being blurry, that I don't think that's really the case. Patterson-Gimlin film, for example, is not blurry at all. People say it is, but it's not. It's actually what it is. You can't be blurry because it's on infinite focus. Everything in the picture is in focus, it turns out. It's just that you're dealing with a 16 millimeter rectangle, a 16 millimeter diagonal rectangle. And the largest that animal is on any frame is 1 millimeter tall. And so that's why it's quote unquote blurry. It's kind of indistinct edges, but it's not blurry at all. Now, of course, it was on film. It wasn't on a digital camera, but everybody understands the idea of pixels, I think. Yeah. Film has something equivalent. They are, what are they called? Well, they're grains, they're film grains. They're little pieces of chemical that are like gravel on the emulsion itself. And each one of those little pieces of gravel, each one of those grains picks up light and they're randomly dispersed across the frame. So that's the smallest detail that can be picked up is something the size of one of those grains on there. And that's what we run into. And there's only so many grains in a 1 millimeter tall figure. So it's not blurry per se. So that's one thing I'd like to say. The PG film is often touted as a blurry piece of footage, but it absolutely is not. Other things like the Freeman footage, for example, it was filmed on this thing called High 8. It was this weird, awkward time in film that was after film itself, but before digital images. And the image was kept on magnetic tape. So there's a certain loss of information that goes on that with the Freeman stuff. So like in the early 90s, that's the film media of choice. But other stuff, I'm thinking most of the pictures that I've seen are pretty okay and reasonably okay. But also picture this, the animal's not going to stand still. Like, hey, stand in front of the picture, stand in front of the statue there and I'm going to take your picture. And so you stand still for 5 or 8 seconds and there you go. But the animals aren't going to do that. They're going to dart behind things. They're going to try to stay out of sight. And I think that's therein lies the reason why some of the Sasquatch stuff is kind of blurry or not up to snuff. There are very few people have high speed film out there that can snap a picture. Well, see an animal, process, oh, that's a Sasquatch, get your camera out, focus it and snap it within a second and a half. Most sightings are about 2 seconds long. Two seconds. And a picture, and you know, as an experiment for years, I was doing this. I would keep a video camera literally on the center console of my car as I drive around going Bigfooting. And what I like to do when I Bigfoot is I'd like to go alone, first of all. I also like to bounce around from spot to spot, spend one or two nights in each spot and try to hit as many spots as possible. That's just what I like to do. It's what I enjoy doing. Maybe it's most productive, maybe it's not. It doesn't matter. That's what I like to do. I like going Bigfoot. I do it for me, not for anybody else.
Yeah.
But I always had this camera next to me when I'm moving around, when driving around. And for a while, a couple of years, I was attempting to film every single piece of wildlife I could, whether it was an owl, a deer, a bear, whatever I ran across on the road in front of me, coming around a corner, I would try to film. And over those years, I probably succeeded in filming like maybe two deer. I filmed a pack of wolves once because one of them sat down. Well, they all ran off. I missed them all. There were three or four, maybe five. But one of them sat down in the middle of the road and looked at me. So that's the only reason I got that one. But anyway, the point is wildlife's extraordinarily difficult to film if you're not ready for it. I have a dash cam now, but back then I was just trying to do this experiment with the camera. It's very, very hard to get any wildlife on camera when you're holding it, you know? So that's why too.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm looking after my neighbor's cats at the moment and it was sunny and they were sat still and I still couldn't get a good photo because they kept turning their heads. So they looked like they were headless cats in the end.
Yeah, if you think it's easy, put a camera in your car and do the same experiment.
Yeah.
You know, and you're going to find that most of the time you miss it.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, Cliff, I'm sorry about this. I don't know why the Zoom's being really awkward. It's always let me just carry on before.
So well, we can do one more and then we can just start a new call if you want.
Yeah. So my next one is, how did the Finding Bigfoot program start? How did you get onto it? How did it all come together?
Production company, actually. The production company is, what were they called? Oh, Ping Pong Entertainment. They have a couple other shows out there and whatever. And they have that, like the Josh Gates show, and they do that those sort of things, like Expedition Unknown or Truth or whatever it is. I don't know. I don't watch TV. I don't like it. But Brad Kuhlman told me, and he's the owner of the production company. He and Casey Brummels own the company. Brad told me that he was thinking, you know what? This is his pitch. He went to the Discovery Networks and who owns Animal Planet. They went to them and said, here's the deal. I grew up in the 1970s. What I remember from the 1970s is Evel Knievel, Farrah Fawcett, and Bigfoot. Evel Knievel's dead. Farrah Fawcett just died. We got to do something about this Bigfoot thing. And that was his pitch and it worked. And they picked it up And at first they try to get actors because most of the shows, most of these paranormal shows, it seems to be staffed by actors or just pretending to be investigators. But they try to get actors, and then they found out pretty quick that actors couldn't really pull this off because they didn't know what they were talking about. They weren't very compelling and all that sort of stuff. So they said, well, you know, why don't we plumb the Bigfoot community? Because there's already these weirdos left there looking for Sasquatch. Let's go poke them. And I got a call one day from a guy in charge of talent is what they call us. I don't know why they call us talent though. And it said, hey, we saw you online. We saw this video you're in, and we've been reading your blog. You sound like a reasonably intelligent guy, and you can communicate effectively. Would this be something you're interested in? You know, yeah, sure, why not? And then they pitched me like land, sea, and air, spare no expense, and all this other stuff that turned out not to be true. But they said, would you be interested? And I go, yeah, sure, whatever. Threw my hat in the ring, and I sent them some footage of me doing some stuff in the woods. And that was in November. I want to say it was 2009. I might be off on that, but I think it was 2009, November 2009. And then I just kind of forgot about it. And then in May of 2010. My friend Matt Moneymaker calls me. He goes, Cliff, you got the spot. And I go, great. What are you talking about? And he goes, well, remember that one dude who called? And I go, oh, that was that really? He goes, yeah, it's me, you, and Bobes, and we're trying to find a scientist right now. I said, no kidding. And basically, we got Renee like about 2 weeks before we filmed the pilot. We went up to Alaska in late June of that year and filmed some stuff. The gals in the editing room pieced together something that seemed okay. And they showed it to the network, and the network goes, oh, this is nice. Let's do six of these. And they bought six. That's the way that does it. They do it. The network buys a certain number of episodes, and they give the money to the production company and say, okay, make us happy. Yeah. Here's a bunch of money. Make us happy.
I was listening to an interview that you did with Emily Fleur, the Forest Fleur. Which was really interesting, and how you were sort of listening to what she said in a very good spirited fashion, I thought. What do you think about Emily and the new young generation of Bigfooters?
Oh, well, I think Emily's a sharp young woman, you know, of course, you know, I don't necessarily agree with her perspective on the Sasquatch, that these things are so human-like and all that other stuff, because I don't see the evidence of it, but that's what she's drawn towards. And I think that's an appropriate avenue of inquiry. And I wish her luck to find cultural evidence and all that sort of stuff. I've been doing it a long time. I haven't seen any. Maybe she'll find something that will convince everybody that, you know, there's something there. But I'm enthused. I'm excited in one way. I mean, this isn't about Emily in particular, by the way. I know her personally. She's a great person. I enjoy her company. She's been in the house for a party before when she's out in Oregon and stuff. Yeah, we're friends. We're legitimately friends.
She seems really nice.
Yeah, total sweetheart, intelligent young woman doing her best to do what she likes to do. And that's what I encourage everyone to do. The next generation coming up, I'm a little worried about in some ways. And this has nothing to do with Emily. You know, I don't want to attach her name to my concerns, but you did ask about the next generation, so to speak. Yeah. The next generation seems to be very, very focused on the social media thing. And that's just the situation they're in. You know, they came in with finding Bigfoot, perhaps, you know, they grew up watching it, that sort of thing, because we're on for a long time. And I get college students in my shop all the time saying, I grew up listening to or watching you on TV. And I go, oh, yeah, I'm old, I know. Mm-hmm. But I think that they're the younger generation, and again, I want to mention, this is not about Emily. I don't know what her reading habits and stuff. The newer generation seems very focused on image rather than content. Mm-hmm. And I see that on YouTube all the time, and Instagram and Facebook. And I don't go on Facebook a whole lot, or really any social media very much. I kind of post and never look because of the trolls out there. But it seems that they are the social media generation. And I think that's going to do a lot of damage to their knowledge base. I am a strong advocate of not learning about Bigfoot from social media or YouTube or television. Yeah. One should learn about Sasquatches by reading books, essentially. I guess I'm just old fashioned. I'm an old fashioned teacher. But I know it takes so much more effort to write a book than it does to make a 3-minute snippet on YouTube. And I think that therein lies the issue with what's coming up. Everybody, you know, the younger generation seems to be pointing at themselves and not pointing at the animals. So that's my concern. And I hope I'm wrong. And I don't I really don't frequent social media. I like Twitter for my news, and I have a lot of quirky accounts I follow. I find Facebook is vitriolic and just poisonous in a lot of ways. And Instagram is, you know, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. And I'm not interested in you, you know, whoever you are. I'm interested in the animals, Sasquatches. And I hope that I'm wrong about this, but it seems that the newer generation is kind of more interested in their own brand than the animals themselves. And that's just me. I guess I'm an old man now, yelling at the kids to get off my lawn. That seems to be me at this point. There's a certain amount of Rene de Hinden in me, I guess, a crotchety old jerk yelling at people. But Emily's a sharp young woman. I've done my best to help her however I can. I'm always here for her. I think I might even be officially on her board of advisors or whatever she has one. I don't know. I don't pay attention to anybody else's stuff but me is the problem. Because I'm only really interested in what I'm doing, because at least I know that's the real deal, and I it's something I can do something about, and I personally like Emily, and I approve of what she's doing in general. I wish her luck on her endeavors, and I'm always here to help her. And the same goes for all the young ones, you know. One of the best guys, best people, I should say, happens to be a man. Coming up is someone you'll never hear about, Connor Anderson. Connor is my Padawan. He's the guy that works at the shop with me. He's the manager here at the shop when I'm not here. And as far as I'm concerned, if somebody asks a question, Connor speaks for me, because I'm doing my best to help him however I can. But he isn't interested at all in social media. He doesn't want his name out there. He doesn't want the people to know who he is. But that's too bad, because I'm going to sing his praises from the mountaintop. He is a sharp young man whose heart and intentions are in the right place. And so there are people like Emily and Connor and a very small number of other people. I'm very encouraged about the next generation. But by and large, man, 80%+ of these people seem to be just pointing at themselves and, you know, wearing silly adventure hats and, you know, saying the right thing on camera. And it's like, man, I've already done the TV thing. You don't know what you're getting into. If you really care about the research, you should avoid that at all costs. I think Connor has it right. Connor has no brand. He just goes Bigfooting. You know, he has virtually no social media presence. He doesn't have a web page. He doesn't do videos. He does videos for my Patreon, the museum membership. That's where you see what Connor is up to. That's where you see what a stellar individual he and my other guy, Nico, who's a 28-year-old tracker and bone expert and paleontology student. You know, those are the people I'm interested in. And actually, no matter what generation, I'm always most interested on the people you've never heard about. So there's a certain irony there. But the more I hear about you, the less I believe what you're doing is what it comes down to. So
I've heard you talk about Connor before. And one day in the future, when I come to visit your museum, I'll be looking forward to meeting him. Is there anything that you would hope that the new generation of Bigfooters do better than you did at the beginning?
At the beginning, well, you know what? At the beginning, I spent my first, like, I started in 94, really. I'm not counting the reading, but like field work in 94. And I think it was in 2001 that I started networking. So I don't know if I want them to do anything better. I want everybody to do their own path. You know, I'm not going to, I'll give my two cents, even though I understand it may only be worth one. I'll give my two cents looking back on my own mistakes and my own path of what I may have done differently, but I want everybody to find their own way. It's one thing to give advice, but I don't want to tell people what they should have done or should be doing, because I believe in complete autonomy over you. Whatever you do, your mind, your soul, your body, or whatever, it's yours. It's none of my business. So I would want them to make their own mistakes, frankly, just like I did. But I think looking back, I would have been further down the road earlier had I started networking earlier. But yeah. I'm not a social person. I don't like, you know, big crowds. I'm really good at being an extrovert, but I am not an extrovert by any stretch of the imagination. like Melissa, my wife, she thought it was really weird because I'll go 20 minutes in the car without saying anything, for example. You know, I really like to go camping alone and be out there. I've gone camping for 2 weeks alone and I found it was great. The only thing better to me than being alone is being with my wife. Which is really saying something more about Melissa than me, but you get the point. So if I had started networking earlier, I probably wouldn't have missed some opportunities that I think I missed. I would have liked really liked to have met Dr. Krantz, for example, or Renee DeHinden, and they both kind of checked out and died before I was, you know, in the circles. So I think that would be the one thing: network earlier than I did, or don't. I don't care. Do what you like to do. You know, follow your own path. You know who you are. Do what you like to do.
Yeah.
And that's the whole thing. And I think that going back to the younger generation thing, it seems that a lot of the people in the younger generation have a goal of some sort to be somebody or to be respected or to be the person who films it and that sort of stuff. And it's very ego driven in a lot of ways. In fact, and it's not just the younger generation, it's the Bigfoot community in general. Everybody wants to be the person who holds the camera. Everybody wants to be Roger Patterson. I got the footage. That makes it about you. I want to be the one that does this. That's about you, not the animals. You know, you kind of have to look to somebody like Mike Green. Mike Green got thermal footage of a Sasquatch. And the way he did it, he put up a camera and left. He didn't hold the camera. He removed his own ego out of it and let the camera do the work. And he succeeded. And that is a very interesting, subtle nod from the universe about the direction we probably should go to. Remove ourselves from the game. This isn't about us. This is about Sasquatches.
Yeah. Slightly connected to that, I've always been really, this is one of my own questions that popped up when I've been watching Finding Bigfoot. So you do the calls on the show. Now, was that more for the TV, or do you actually believe that the calls will help to bring the Bigfoot to you?
Both, actually. I have a number of spots here in Mount Hood National Forest that I go to, and I don't really do calls so much. I might do a couple knocks. I might do one or two calls, but I don't really hit it hard like we do in the show. Mm. Because here's the thing. If you are in an area, imagine I go camping alone. I don't always have a fire. That means I'm sitting in a chair in the dark until like 2 a.m, right? How would a Bigfoot a half mile away even know I'm there? Right. If they just wander into the situation, they're on their route, they're doing their thing. And, you know, at 11 o'clock, they're wandering close enough, but they don't see me or hear me. How would they even know to come investigate unless I make noise? Right. So that's one thing. But I, for the most part, I don't really do it as much as we do in the show. That's for sure. Because I don't want to like pollute my areas. Cause you know, I think Sasquatches are smart. They're smarter than bears, but they're not rocket scientists. They're not doing math or fire. They're not even close to human intelligence as far as I can tell. I won't be able to fool them very much. If they connect those noises to me, game's over, right? So I don't really overdo it basically. But on the TV show, that's different. That's really different, actually, because we have 9 days in a location to film, right? And at least 2 of those nights, we're out in the woods doing a night investigation. And if there's a camping trip, you know, if I'm the camper that trip, then I get 2 or 3 more nights, probably.
Yeah.
But on those 2 nights, just picture like, you know, those 2 nights, we have the best intelligence, the best Bigfoot intelligence we can gather. Because between Matt's sighting database and the BFRO and my sightings database, I mean, Matt has a lot more reports. Matt does a great job with the public database. There's no reason to post my sightings, my database, because Matt does such a great job. But I've got about 1,500 sighting reports, near as I can figure. So between my database, Bobo's connections, he doesn't keep a database per se, but he knows a lot of people. And then Matt Moneymaker's BFRO database, and his researchers that generally work in the area that we're going, his researchers say, well, no, you need to go to this spot because we had something 2 weeks ago or last week or yesterday. Sometimes we have the best, we had the best up-to-date information anywhere in the Bigfoot world, period. That's not an arrogant statement. That's a fact. So we got into an area and we have one night. We have between, you know, like 9 o'clock at night and 3 a.m. or so, sometimes later if we need to, because we have to stay out until we get enough story, whatever story happens. We don't know when we go out what's going to happen, whether we're going to trip and fall, run into a bear, or get a Sasquatch knock. We don't know. We have to go until something happens. That's a lot of pressure, man, because about 1 million people or so are going to see this in the next week or two, or, you know, once it's aired, you know, 3 months down the line, once it airs, about 1 million people are going to watch this. And there's a lot of pressure. I mean, to have anything happen, let alone find a Sasquatch, like, talk about the most impossible task ever, right? Go here. You have one night, go find a Bigfoot for us on television, and we're all going to watch you do it. That's a tremendous amount of pressure, you know? And so the only way to really do that and get some sort of result is by the quick and dirty sort of method. It's what I call it, the quick and dirty, where we go in for one night, make a lot of noise, and see if we can stir one up. You know, that's TV. That's not the way I treat my spots. That's not the way I do things long term. But we have one night in this one spot in West Virginia or something. I'm not going to come back there anytime soon because I've got other shows to film. And I even now I can't afford to go flying around to West Virginia to go back. So like I literally have one night in this spot to see who's home, if anybody's home at all. Yeah. And the only way you can really effectively do that without lying and faking stuff is to go in and make a big bunch of noise. That's why we had these ridiculous. And oh, by the way, that's another thing too I've got to address. I got a lot of criticism on the show because hunters and stuff would say, no, you're doing it all wrong. Don't go in and make a bunch of noise. You have to sit in a chair up in a tree and dress in camo and descent yourself and just sit silently for 9 hours. I said, well, God, that's terrible television. That's like the worst TV show ever, right? Yeah, so, yeah, that works. Sure, you can do that. And you can do that for 100 nights and maybe get a Bigfoot. Maybe, you know, but what? No one's going to watch it. No one's going to watch it, you know. Even hunters wouldn't watch that.
Exactly. There's a reason why right. People don't sit and watch hunters hunting.
Right, it's boring. Yeah. It's boring. Even hunters fall asleep in their tree stands. I know that. They tell me. So again, that going in making a big splash. Well, Sasquatches are smart, and their whole gig is knowing what's happening in their particular territory. If somebody comes in, makes a whole hullabaloo, maybe they're going to come check it out. Maybe they're going to come closer. And sure enough, sometimes they do. I mean, the only one I saw was on the show, really. You know, I mean, it came in to check us out. When I saw it, it was standing on the hill watching us. That's it. It was going, what the hell is going on here? Because this doesn't usually happen here. That's what it was doing. And of course, you know, throwing a rave in the woods, or, you know, shooting off cannons or playing drums or bass guitar in the woods or whatever. All that, this is, it's ridiculous TV stuff. But if you look behind it, all of those ridiculous avenues of inquiry are essentially the same thing. Make a bunch of noise in an area where there might be one, and maybe it'll come closer. That's it. And we have one night to do it in, and 1 million people are watching. You kind of got to do that, essentially.
Yeah. And how did you feel when you saw it then? What was going through your mind?
Well, actually, when I saw it through a thermal imager in North Carolina, Uari National Forest in 2011 there. I was mostly wondering, because it was actually, honestly, it was the first night investigation we ever did, beside the pilot. And we're there, and we were having trouble with the production because they were saying, hear that? That was a Bigfoot. And we're going, no, that was a car. We heard that was a car echoing down from like 2 miles away. And no, it was a Bigfoot. And we're going, we're not going to lie for you, you know, and that sort of stuff. And so we were kind of clashing at that moment, very first night out in the woods. And I was worried that because we hadn't even seen a show yet. We'd never seen a show. Because it hadn't aired yet. And we were very paranoid. Bigfooters in general are paranoid individuals, paranoid and suspicious, I find, and myself included. And I was very worried about how they were going to edit us into some ridiculous clownish Scooby-Doo thing or what. So I was very cautious being on camera at that point before we built a trust with the production company, which they earned and deserved from the very beginning, but were suspicious jerks, it turns out. But while my eyes were on it, I was more or less questioning, is that a person or a Sasquatch? Because there was no other option. But it walked so strangely, and it was one color head to toe, which implies that it wasn't wearing clothing. Yeah. And, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, mile and a half, 2 miles off trail, and in a place where no one else should be, that there had been recurring sighting reports over years. And it's like, well, is that one? Am I seeing one now for the first time in my life on camera? And I didn't want to give it to the TV show, so to speak, because I didn't know what they would do to me, you know? So it was mostly processing. I didn't, like so many witnesses, I didn't have the pleasure of really looking at a Bigfoot. I had the inner turmoil of trying to figure out what I was looking at.
Wow. Gosh, that would be amazing. I mean, looking back on it now, you must think, oh my goodness, I wish I had been able to enjoy that moment.
Yeah, well, that's what keeps me going out in the woods, try to get another one.
Yeah. Now I'm going to ask you a slightly trivial question now, which is, and I'm sure that hundreds of people have asked you this, but this is for me. If you stepped out from behind a tree and came face to face with a Bigfoot, we're talking like 6 feet away, do you honestly think you would back away, or do you think you would try to communicate? And I know it's hard to say because you don't know how you adapt in the situation, but what do you think?
Well, I've been in a number of situations that through the years, and when, especially when I was younger, you know, young people are, I said, I would do this or I would do that. And it's like, every time I'm in a situation like that, it turns out that all my predictions were completely incorrect, totally wrong. So I've kind of stopped. I guess wisdom of old age means I've totally stopped guessing what I would do. Yeah. I would like to take it all in and enjoy the moment because I know it's not going to last. But in a situation like that, honestly, you can't plan ahead. You can rehearse and practice and try to do something like Roger Patterson did. He actually rehearsed getting the camera out of his saddlebag and stuff, and that'll help. But when you're actually there, I don't think any amount of mental preparation is going to put you there. Yeah, just a few weeks ago, about a month or two ago now, my sense of time is rather elastic. I was hiking and I was doing some solo hiking at dusk, which isn't a good idea, but I'm not that smart. And I was trying to see animals, and that's a great time to do it. I came around a rock wall, and I was 20 feet from a black bear, a mother black bear, and there was a cub nearby, and I didn't know it at the time. And like, the first thing I did is like, oh, cool, a black bear. Then I went like, oh, crap, a black bear. It was right there. And the adrenaline takes over at that point, and you just do the best you can with the situation. So if somebody tells you, no, I would reach out my hand and look into its soft eyes and really try to share my feelings, and because I know they're empathetic. And it's like, no, nonsense. You're going to crap your pants and then do whatever comes naturally next, because you can't prepare for that. I really don't think you can prepare for that.
Yeah.
I would just hope I can take it in.
The black bear, what did you do? That's my one of my biggest fears. That's why I'm glad I live in the UK.
Black bears are big dogs, essentially. You know, they're potentially dangerous, just like any, you know, 120-pound Rottweiler would be, right? But essentially at the end of the day, they're big dogs. So like when I came around the corner, it was standing on its hind legs sniffing the air. It smelled me coming because I had the wind at my back. And when I saw, and like I said, I kind of thought to myself, oh, cool, a black bear. Then I went like, oh, crap, a black bear right there. And so I looked at it, and it kind of looked at me. And then I raised my hand and went, ah! And then it kind of looked at me like, well, you didn't really have to do that, man. And like it kind of went down on all fours and walked away. And then I backed up because there was a rock wall there. And I knew there was some sort of safety in a way. There's a rock wall on the left-hand side of the trail. So I backed up. I luckily brought my bear spray. I didn't need it that day, which is even more lucky, but I did have bear spray on me because I don't always hike with that sort of thing, but I tried to. And it was a national park, and I think I'm allowed to bring fire. I have a fire. I'm not a gun guy. I'm not like a lot of Americans. I know these people, and most of them are really good folks, and some of them are paranoid militia weirdos and stuff. But for the most part, most people are responsible gun owners and stuff like that. But I don't bring my I have a sidearm. I don't bring that camping for the most part because it's much easier to recover from a misfired bear spray than it is a misfired bullet. And really, it's all you need anyway, because people are the most dangerous thing in the woods by far.
Yeah.
And people will react equally poorly to bear spray as a bear would. But anyway, I grabbed my bear spray, pulled it out, and I was filming from our Patreon account. We have a museum membership that I mentioned. And we make content. So all of our museum members, even at the lowest level of membership, get two video documentaries a month that we make in the museum. And so I was documenting a lot of my hike, but of course the camera wasn't running right then. And, you know, and just like every other wildlife shot, I blew it, didn't get it. If it was a Sasquatch, I would miss that opportunity too. But I pulled the camera out in one hand and started filming myself narrating, like, holy crap, guys, I just ran across a Bigfoot, or I mean a black bear, sorry. And I had the bear spray in the other hand, and I was backing up thinking, now that's a big bear. I mean, it was at least as tall as I was. It was a very large female black bear. Very well fed. It was clearly very healthy animal. And I backed up and I was thinking, okay, well, I'm going to back up down the trail in case it comes around the corner. I got to see this thing coming. And then I heard scratch, 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 pop, pop, pop. And I go, oh, it's climbing a tree. Interesting. So I went back down the trail to where I saw it and kind of peeked around the edge there. And to the tree, and I saw a tree shaking. Oh, there's a black bear. Cool, there's a black bear in that tree. So I get the, so I step over to where it was standing, and I start trying to film the black bear up in the tree, thinking, okay, cool, I get to at least film a black bear and show our museum members what's going on. And I'm trying to focus on it, but it's autofocus and it keeps catching the leaves in the foreground and that sort of stuff. And I finally focus on it, and I'm looking at the viewfinder and I go, that's not the same black bear I just saw. And I take the camera down, and sure enough, it wasn't. Mother was about 30 feet away from me at the base of the tree that she sent her yearling cub up into, kind of looking at me, tripping out, going, you're not acting like the other tourists act. What's going on here? And it was like looking at me, trying to size me up, like, do I need to kill you or no? And so funny, when I go back to look at the footage, you know, because I was trying to film the thing in the tree. When I go back to look at the footage, I panned across mom like two or three times. You can totally see her in the viewfinder, but I was so focused up in the tree at the bear that I knew was there. I didn't see the bear that I didn't know was there. Yeah. And then from there, I said, well, mom and cubs, I am out of here. So I kind of yeah. walked backwards for a while, and I would hear them a few, like going, make bear noises behind me for a while. And yeah, then and I was about a little over a mile from my car. So I had to back out at dusk, knowing there's mom and a cub not far away, hoping they're not trailing me out, hoping I don't look as delicious as I feel. And then halfway back, I heard another bear on the other side doing a similar huffing noise. And I'm thinking, oh man, Cliff, what are you doing? I got back to the car and made a good video out of it, and you know, for our patrons and stuff. Oh, so
that's just brought me out in a hot sweat.
It was a very adrenaline filled hike, I'll say that. But you know, it's not the first, and it won't be the last time I run into bears. It's just in general, you know, if you can handle a big dog, you can probably handle a bear. They're not really interested in killing or eating you. And you hear about the attacks, but you don't hear about the hundreds, if not thousands, of people who just leave the area and are left alone. And chances are that's probably what's going to happen if you keep your head about you. I mean, things do go wrong. I'm not going to say that bears are not dangerous. They're very dangerous, potentially, at least. But then again, so are Sasquatches. You know, these things are 800, 1,000, 1,200 pounds of wild man, you know, and I can't think of anything scarier than that. So
I know, and yet many people who've sighted them say that it's almost like they're being allowed to leave. When the Sasquatch sees them, they get the feeling that they're not welcome, or it makes noises, and the person quite rightly does what you did and retreated, but they're allowed to leave. I mean, obviously, there are some stories out there of people being attacked, but I would think if you were being attacked, you wouldn't be around to tell the story.
So, that's the thing. We don't hear from the people who didn't survive.
Exactly.
But then again, I don't think they're out to get us either. I don't want people to, I mean, they're potentially dangerous. They're wild animals. They're wild animals. You know, no matter what else they are, they're wild animals. And they're very large. They're potentially dangerous. But if they were out to get us, I think there'd be very few of us left by now. You know, we would have gone after them with pitchforks and torches a long time ago, you know, but there are very few stories of people being hurt, and people say, oh, it's going to kill me. And they say, nonsense. If it was going to kill you, you wouldn't be here now. You cannot escape a Sasquatch. And in my opinion, you simply cannot. They're too good, too fast, too strong, too smart.
Yeah.
And you're not any of those things. You know,
exactly. We're just mere mortals. I noticed on your website that you have the Sumatra project for the
Orang Pendek project.
So if you sort of think about all, and I'm not going to name them all because I can't remember them all, but all the different types of similar creatures, you know, the Orang Pendek and the Yeti and blah 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 blah, do you think they're all related, or are they, let me get this right, are they all hominins?
No, I don't think they're all hominins. No, they're not all hominins, that's certain. Okay. But hominoid, yes. Hominoid is a fancy term that means human-shaped thing. You know, right. But then again, the gorilla is a hominoid, really, if you want to get into it. It's a human-shaped thing. Yeah. Linnaeus, actually, the godfather of taxonomy, would look at it and say, well, these are awfully, so they have got fingers and toes, and they look a lot like humans, but they were so biased towards Christianity at that time, the naturalists, because science didn't exist, they were naturalists at that time. They were so biased towards Christianity and our placement only under God or whatever the trip is there, and how our dominion over everything, that they couldn't accept that we were just another animal. They just couldn't accept it. And there's still residue of that mindset today and certainly throughout America. I know that Europe in general is a more secular society than America is. I think Orang Pendek, if these footprint casts are real, and some of them are not, I'll tell you that now, some of them are not, but some of them are. If these things are real, they're not hominins necessarily, because the big toe is off to the side like a thumb. Okay. In other words, it's an abducted helix. So I think that these are probably some sort of bipedal orangutan, some sort of small bipedal orangutan, but I don't know. But the fact that there are stories of hairy human-like hominoids all from a lot of places in the world is really interesting, because it kind of furthers the idea of relict hominoids. Relict is a biological term that means still surviving in small numbers, and hominoid is human-shaped thing, as you said. Oh, 9 more minutes for your thing. There was a revolution in paleoanthropology just a few decades ago, like the late 1980s into the 1990s. And before that, we thought that there were, like, evolution was kind of a linear thing. You know, like Homo heidelbergensis was here, and then Neanderthals showed up, and Neanderthals were just better at being alive than heidelbergensis was, and essentially drove them extinct, outcompeted them. And then humans, Homo sapiens, showed up, and we were just better at everything, so we drove Neanderthals extinct. And that's not the way evolution happens, it turns out. It's not a linear progression. It's not this great chain of being like Linnaeus postulated back in the 1600s. It's not like that at all. It's not a tree trunk. It's a bush with all these different branches going off. And some of the branches persist for longer in time than others. And some of them persist to the present day. Humans, for example, that is a branch that is still persisting to the present day. No one would argue that. I would argue that some of these species that went out, that went extinct relatively recently may not have gone extinct. And there might even be a few types of animals, hominins, which is a fancy word that means anything on our family tree, since we broke off from chimpanzees about 6 million years ago. Anything after that is a hominin. Neanderthals are hominins. Homo heidelbergensis are hominins. Homo naledi, hominins. All these are hominins. We're hominins. I would suspect that some of these did not go extinct and have persisted to the present day in small areas, far-flung corners of the world, in very small populations. And that's what we're dealing with. And the fact that in the last 100,000 years, humans have been here. Homo sapiens have been here for about 300,000 years. But just in the last 150,000 years. So humans have been around. Neanderthals, when the last Homo erectus, Homo naledi, Homo luzonensis, one of the newer species. There were two new species discovered about a year ago in July 2021. Two new species of close Neanderthal relatives. The dragon man was one of them. There's another one discovered in Israel, but gosh, dragon man is such a sexier name that it got all the media attention, you know? And then there's Homo floresiensis, the hobbit species. And last Homo heidelbergensis were around as well. I'm probably missing one or two, but there's 9 off the top of my head in the last 150,000 years. That's a relatively recent time period, really, geologically speaking. Who's to say they're all extinct? Who's to say that we've even discovered all the species that have been around? Clearly not, because there's been 3 since 2019 that have been discovered. So clearly. Oh, and then Denisovans, there's another one I neglected to mention. So anyway, you see what I'm saying. There are a lot of different species of hominin alive at the same time on the planet, and in some cases in the same area of the planet. You might have caught that news item a few months ago about a closer look at one of the Lea Tolle footprint tracks. The famous Lea Tolle tracks were done by Australopithecus afarensis. But it turns out that there's another trackway in the same Lea Tolle strata that they thought was a bear, but it turns out it wasn't a bear at all. They're thinking, oh my God, this is another hominin trackway, and it's not it's not Australopithecus afarensis. It's another species. We just don't know what it is. Right. So there's two species living in that part of Africa at that same general time right there. There's evidence of it. So the fact that there are relict hominoids reported worldwide is kind of exactly what you would expect to find with our current model of how evolution works.
Yeah. Gosh, I mean, I'd love to, if I could be, you know, sometimes I wish I could have a time machine, or I wish I could, and this always happens when I'm watching Bigfoot programs, is I wish I could zoom out kind of like on Google Earth and look at where all of the Bigfoots are and the Yetis and the Orang Pendek, and be able to see the whole picture of where all these creatures are hiding. That would just be incredible.
It would be cool, but, you know, maybe after we're dead, you know.
Yeah. Maybe that's the key. Maybe we can do it when we come back after we're dead. Maybe that is it.
As soon as I'm dead, whoever's in charge here, I'm just going to ask, show me all the times that a Sasquatch saw me, but I didn't see it. That's what I want to know.
Oh, wow. Yes. That would be amazing. And then, find out how many times you nearly died because the creature was going to come and eat you, but didn't in the end.
I'm sure I will nearly die a lot of times until I get it right. Yeah.
So I have one final question, because I'm desperately trying to fix this Zoom account while I'm doing this, and hopefully I might be able to do it. I have a question, which is not related to Bigfoot, but I run my own tiny podcast. I mean, literally there's a handful of people who listen to it. And I started out being interested in ghosts. And what I wanted to know from you was, have you had any other paranormal experiences, such as seeing a ghost or a UFO or anything like that? And can you tell us about it?
Yeah, sure, sure. They just scared the hell out of me. I don't want anything to do with it. I've seen two UFOs. I saw very briefly, I saw a shooting star change direction in mid-flight back in about 2000 or something, and they don't do that. And then a couple of years ago on my own property, I saw what I thought was the International Space Station go over, but it kind of slowed down and stopped and changed directions. And it doesn't do that either. So I don't know what it is. Unidentified, check. Flying, checked. Object, that's a given. So yeah, UFO. I don't know what it is. I don't know what that is. And I've had I've had a handful of weird things that one may or may not consider ghost things, but my wife's into ghosts and stuff. And I had one thing when I was in high school that the sheets were picked up. I was staying at my grandmother's house when my parents were out of town. The sheets were picked up and something was getting in bed with me. And I hit something and I heard a oof. The sheets dropped and I laid in terror for the next 3 or 4 hours until I fell asleep. And then the last time I had something really horrifying happen to me. I hear weird noises and stuff sometimes, but you know, I don't know what that is. But the last time I had something really horrifying happen to me was probably about 5 or 6 years ago. My wife's grandmother died that day or the day before. And she had to fly back to Pittsburgh, where she's from, to go to deal with family stuff. And something woke me up in the middle of the night, and I was laying on my side, and I saw somebody standing by the door of my bedroom. And the person vaguely looked like Melissa, but she was standing there. She had long hair draped over her face, so I couldn't see her, but it kind of looked like Melissa. And she was dressed in a night robe. She wasn't wearing shoes, I remember. And she was kind of like going back and forth like this. And I don't know why, it's like stepping back and forth. And I said, oh, I'm clearly dreaming here. So I kind of cleared my eyes, cleared my head, closed them and stuff, and opened my eyes again. And she was still there. And that's when I got real scared. And so I reached for my light, and she just kind of went and like disappeared, kind of whisked out the door. And then I called the dog into the room and again laid awake in terror until the adrenaline faded away and I could go to sleep. So I've had a couple, you know, ghost things happen, seen a couple UFOs, but I have so little interest in that stuff. Just because whatever that is, it can stay the hell away from me. I didn't enjoy it. It scared me. I didn't like it. I don't want to get to the bottom of that mystery. I've got giant ape men to contend with.
Exactly. You can only sort of do one thing well at a time. I always say that about my teaching, because people say, oh, what do you teach? What do you teach? I say, I teach children. What do you do? I'm a primary school teacher, you know. I don't do anything in depth. I'm a jack of all trades and master of none.
School teacher. Yeah, that's why. Yeah.
And I wish that I had one thing that I was really good at. I think my problem is, as you say, I love all the paranormal things. I try to spread myself too thinly. Therefore, I know nothing about many things. maybe one day I should try and focus on one area like you do.
Perhaps not then. You know, I mean, who knows?
Yeah. Oh, well, Cliff, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. And I've really, really enjoyed it. There's going to be an article out in Paranormality magazine next month. And it's just been fantastic. And you've been so easy to talk to. I was very nervous about talking to you, I have to say.
I'm just a dude.
You know, that's what my son Sam said. He said, "Mum, he's just a guy." And I said, "Yeah, well, that's all very well for you to say."
I'm just a Bigfoot nerd like everybody else. Yeah.
But thank you very much for coming
thank
on
you.
The
I
podcast.
It.
And it's I hope to speak to you again in the future. But right. Have a great rest of your day, and thank you again. And I'll let you know when the article's out.
Please do. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. See you later. Bye.
Thank you so much to Cliff for that interview. I still love to listen to it even now, and I hope that he will be able to come back on the podcast one day. So I hope you really enjoyed it as much as I have. And don't forget, you need to be writing in and sending in your experiences via voicemail to me, because I really, really still want to have a feature on the show, and still people are not willing to share their experiences with me. What is it? Are you keeping them to yourself? Are you hugging them to your chest? Are you sharing them with other people? Please don't. Please send your experiences to me at paranormalorwhatpodcast@outlook.com. That's paranormalorwhatpodcast@outlook.com. Or phone me. Let's have a chat. Leave me a message. Leave me your experience on 07935 100 162. That's 07935 100 162. So next week, I will be interviewing the lovely, delicious, and extremely witty, funny, and clever lady who is Penny Griffiths Morgan, historian, who can be seen on Celebrity Help My House is Haunted and regular Help My House is Haunted. So that will be a real hour of fun with Penny. I'm also going to be talking to a senior gentleman from the USA called Claire, who's a very seasoned paranormal investigator, and I'm looking forward to finding out his wisdom on the best equipment to use and listening to lots of his own paranormal experiences. So keep listening to the podcast, and please tell your friends about it. Please rate and review the podcast. Ooh, and also I forgot to tell you that I am going to be changing the artwork for the podcast, because my favourite picture, sorry, I should say painting, of all time is The Scream by Edvard Munch. However, I do need to update the artwork. So my little artwork at the moment is a stock one, but it just reminded me of The Scream, which is why I like it so much. So I actually dragged my kids out to the woods the other day. That sounds bad, doesn't it? But I did, in the twilight and the sunshine, and we did lots and lots and lots of photography of them standing dressed all in black under various creepy trees and groves and things like that. And actually, we got some really, really good photography. So I'm then going to do a little bit of manipulating and add a little bit of writing onto it. I've had a little bit of help from my friend Paramike with that, and hopefully we'll be unveiling the new artwork very soon. And beyond that, the podcast app that I use is Spotify for Podcasters, and they are taking away my comfort blanket soon, because I do a lot of my recording on my phone because the quality comes out quite well. And on the phone app, you can add in all sorts of little sounds and interludes, and it's really easy. Even I can use it. And they're taking away that facility later in the year. So what I'm going to be doing is doing a little bit of homework and trying to update my technical knowledge when it comes to adding things into the podcast. So you never know, you might get some extra music. The beautiful, spooky introduction and exit music that we have on the show so far has been written by my fabulous husband, and we're hoping to have more of it. So we are trying to upgrade. I am trying to move with the times so that I can get a few more listeners. And if anybody's got any advice on how to improve the podcast, be nice, people. I'm very fragile. Be nice. If you haven't got anything nice to say, please don't say it at all. But if there's any advice that you want to tell me about how you think we could get more listeners to the podcast, because we're kind of plodding on, a few hundred at the moment, but it would be really nice to reach a few people further out in the world. So if you've got any advice, podcasting advice for me, please come to our Facebook page, Paranormal or What Podcast Facebook page, and just give me some tips. See what we think. Let's turn this from an amateur podcast into a bit of a professional one. What do you reckon? I will love you forever if you help me. Right, I'm off now. I'm off to go and get my tot of something hot and spicy. I am off to snuggle under a blanket and to relax and listen to some meditation. So until next week, take care. Have a great week, and good night.